This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled The Great Tours, England, Scotland, and Wales. Your lecturer is Patrick N. Allett. Dr. Allett is the Colquhoun Family Professor of American History at Emory University. He received his PhD in American History from the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Allett is the author of 5 scholarly books, numerous articles and reviews for academic and popular journals, and a memoir about his life as a college professor. A longtime lecturer for the Great Courses, Professor Allett's other courses include The Rise and Fall of the British Empire, Victorian Britain, the Industrial Revolution, and The Art of Teaching. Lecture 1. Welcome to Britain.
Great Britain is central to the history of civilization, has been heavily populated for centuries, and is full to the brim of fascinating landscapes, cities, castles, cathedrals, parks, gardens, and inventions. Some of the most original and interesting people in world history lived there, including Shakespeare, Isaac Newton, Horatio Nelson, Isambard Brunel, Charles Darwin, Queen Victoria, and Winston Churchill. From Britain, thousands of enterprising people emigrated to settle other parts of the world, including the founders of the American colonies, Australia, and Canada. One of the less well-known emigrants is me. I was born in central England in the 1950s, grew up in the Derbyshire village of Micklover, went to college at Oxford University, but then, in the late 1970s, travelled to America, where I studied for the PhD in history at the University of California, Berkeley. Through a series of happy coincidences, I ended up living and working in the United States and became a US citizen in 2012. Still, I go back to England 2 or 3 times every year and feel equally at home in both countries. I think my vantage point, with 1 foot in and 1 foot out of Britain, has helped me gain some perspective on the country's history and on its immense value to our civilization. I love it, and I love to be there. Over the course of this and the next 35 lectures, I hope I'll be able to convey to you my enthusiasm for Britain and to point out some of the best places you should visit when you have a chance to go. Even if you're just an armchair traveller, stay with me and learn about the history and culture of an island nation that has played an outsized role on the global stage. Britain is the land where the Industrial Revolution began and where many of the ideas central to our world originated, including ideas about democracy, individual rights, freedom of the press, and the rule of law. For at least 1,000 years, its most articulate and literate people have been keeping detailed records. And for 1,000 years before that, it was swept by the great movements of peoples across the ancient world. Centuries of internal peace and a widespread interest in preserving the nation's heritage have ensured that evidence of all the ages of British life can still be found impressed on the landscape. It is possible to see superb examples of the ancient civilizations that lived there, including Maiden Castle, a great Iron Age hill fortress in the southwestern county of Dorset, and Stonehenge, the mysterious stone circle and earthwork in nearby Wiltshire. Roman conquest in the first century of the Christian era also made a vivid and lasting impression. Best of the Roman remains is Hadrian's Wall, near the current border of England and Scotland. It marked the boundary between the Britons Rome had subdued and the wild men who lived further north. Equally impressive are the Roman baths in the aptly named spa town of Bath in southwestern England. Its fashionable revival in the 18th century and its appearance in books like Jane Austen's Persuasion make Bath a popular, very worthwhile visitor's destination. When the Romans left Britain, the country fragmented into petty chiefdoms and was invaded by Danish, Viking and Anglo-Saxon tribesmen from northern Europe. This was the era of the legendary King Arthur. Several places in England with scattered and picturesque ruins claim to be the original Camelot. Eventually, the Anglo-Saxons formed seven kingdoms, the Heptarchy, and fought with one another for supremacy. Each wanted to become the Bretwalda, or King of the Britons. It's not quite so easy to find Anglo-Saxon vestiges in Britain as Roman ones. They're usually smaller and more fragile. On the other hand, an incredible Anglo-Saxon funeral longboat and treasure hoard found at Sutton Hoo in the 1930s is one of the great archaeological sensations of the 20th century. Maybe not quite the equal of Tutankhamun's tomb in Egypt, but not far off. Once we reach the High Middle Ages in British history, the historical record and the variety of objects still visible today swells immensely. Front and centre stand literally thousands of medieval churches. There are so many that some are shabby and neglected, even though they're 700, 800 or 900 years old. Many have been extensively renovated over the centuries, but they still give us vivid testimony of the powerful faith of Catholic England between the Norman conquest of 1066 and the Reformation of the 16th century. As a child, I was a choir boy at All Saints Church in Micklover, built in the early 1300s, extensively renovated in the Victorian era, wonderfully attractive, and yet too familiar to most English men and women to draw even a passing glance. One of the quintessential experiences of travel in England is to pass through the great oak door of a rural parish church like All Saints and into the musty interior, where a brass eagle lectern holds the Bible, where stained glass windows retell biblical stories, and where old grave markers commemorate the passing of village squires through the centuries. The great cathedrals overshadow the parish churches and draw the lion's share of visitors' attention. They nearly all date from the era 1100 to 1500, and I'll have much to say about them in the lectures that follow. The most famous of all are Westminster Abbey in London, where generations of kings and queens have been crowned, and Canterbury Cathedral, where the martyrdom of St. Thomas a Becket made it a great medieval pilgrimage, and which now serves as the world centre of the Anglican Church. Both, unfortunately, are now so popular that to visit them is to join a great scrum of other tourists, which makes it hard to appreciate their beauty. Ironically, the only time they're empty is during services, when the tourists temporarily step outside and give the remaining handful of British Christians their chance to worship. There's much to be said for visiting the equally magnificent and much quieter cathedrals of Lichfield, Durham, Winchester, and many others. Equally impressive are the medieval castles, wonderful to visit today for people of all ages. They show, in the clearest possible way, just how dangerous and warlike life in Britain used to be. Our enjoyment is based on earlier generations' misery, fear, and eagerness to intimidate each other. There are dozens of examples, and I'll take you through several of them, including Conwy Castle in Wales, Warwick Castle in central England, and Dover Castle on the south coast. By looking at the great structures built in Britain between 1500 and 1700, it's possible to trace the rise of political stability in Britain. Henry VIII, who's notorious for us for having married six wives and for killing two of them in the 1530s and 40s, also managed to abolish private armies, which made internal warfare less frequent than it had been in the foregoing age during the Wars of the Roses. A great civil war convulsed England in the 1640s, but after that, Britain enjoyed almost uninterrupted stability for the next 3.5 centuries. The great houses from this era show a decline in the importance of fortifications and a new interest in comfort and luxury. They also bear witness to the fact that Britain was highly stratified by social class, with a small group of rich aristocrats and merchants right at the top, who competed with each other for ostentation and magnificence. By our standards, it was a horribly unjust world. And yet, in a paradoxical way, we benefit from that injustice now by having these great houses, gardens, and art collections available to visit and enjoy. Among them, I'll introduce you to Chatsworth, Kedleston, and Cork in Derbyshire, Blickling in Norfolk, and Melford in Suffolk. One of the characteristic emotions of visiting Britain's great houses, I think, is to be simultaneously impressed by the achievement and horrified by the colossal inequality they represent. For most of its history, Britain was far more rural than urban. Even today, despite a population of 65 million, it retains much wild country and large areas of farmland. Go back far enough in history, and you'll find a country almost entirely forested. Human demand for firewood and building materials meant that the forest was cut down nearly everywhere, surviving best when set aside from public use by kings and noblemen who wanted forest preserves for hunting. Today, the characteristic landscape of England's hill country, the Pennines, the Lake District, Dartmoor, and much of Scotland and Wales, is of deforested land, dotted with sheep and crisscrossed by dry stone walls. The hillsides have been bare of trees for so long, it's hard not to think of this as their natural condition. None of them are high. Britain's highest mountain, Ben Nevis, in Scotland, is only a shade over 4,000 feet. But they are steep and often wild, providing plenty of challenges to hikers and climbers. One of the very best ways to visit Britain is on foot. If you have time, I counsel you to walk part of one of the great network of footpaths that originated in ancient times and have been carefully preserved right up to the present. Among the greatest are, first, the Pennine Way. It begins in Derbyshire and leads north up the centre of the country into the lowlands of Scotland. Second is the Pembrokeshire Coastal Path in Wales that will take you along cliff tops and across broad estuaries. Third is the Ridgeway across the chalk hills of central southern England, and based on ancient paths that have been trodden for thousands of years. We think of industrialization as linked directly to cities, and eventually that was true. But the earliest industrial factories were built in hilly, rural areas, where fast-flowing rivers powered water wheels linked to the machinery. In the Derwent Valley of Derbyshire, at Cromford, you can visit the world's first water-powered cotton spinning mill, built by Richard Arkwright in 1771. The great water wheel has gone, but the mill race that brought high-pressure water to turn it is preserved. 100 miles southwest of there, in Shropshire, you can find Colebrookdale, the valley where the great innovations of English iron-making began, and where the world's first iron bridge, finished in 1779, still stands over the River Severn. Throughout this valley, a cluster of industrial museums has been created, beautifully preserving an important part of Britain's national heritage. Britain was not only a rising industrial nation in the 1700s, it was also a great seafaring nation, which projected its power across the world and built an empire on which the sun never set. No wonder it still bears so many signs of its seafaring traditions. The obvious place to start is at Portsmouth on the south coast, where you'll find immaculately preserved HMS Victory, flagship of Admiral Nelson, on whose deck he died at the climax of the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805. Nearby stands the hull of the Mary Rose, a ship of Henry VIII's navy that was launched in 1510 and sank in 1545. Its discovery and successful raising from the seabed in 1982 was a splendid feat of marine archaeology, while the thousands of artifacts recovered from it give us a richer picture of 16th century sailors' world than ever before. Equally engrossing are the fast sailing clipper ship Cutty Sark at Greenwich in the Thames Estuary and the pioneering ocean-going steamer Great Britain at Bristol. The Great Britain, built in 1843 and in its day the world's longest and fastest ship, was restored to its former glory in the 1970s. These great ships, and many smaller ones in ports around the nation, bear witness to Britain's powerful association with the sea. Many visitors from abroad devote much of their time in Britain to its capital, London. That's a pity in a way, because London is so unrepresentative of the country as a whole. On the other hand, there's no denying what a treasure house it is of fascinating places and magnificent buildings. If I had to single out three as particularly deserving of your attention, I'd make the uncontroversial choice of the Tower of London, Buckingham Palace, and the Houses of Parliament. The Tower was built by King William the Conqueror, starting in the year 1078, and its history for the next seven centuries was directly linked to royal affairs. It was a fortress, an armory, a garrison, a mint, but above all, a prison, in whose dungeons languished suspected traitors, and on whose yards many were put to death, including Henry VIII's hapless queens, Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard. Incidentally, it's not a tower in the sense of being tall and thin and cylindrical. Instead, it's a massive series of fortifications, about which I'll have more to say later in the course. Buckingham Palace is far more recent. Begun as a much smaller house in 1703, it was enlarged in the 1760s and again much more extensively in the 1820s. Only when Queen Victoria moved in, on her accession in 1837, did it become the principal London residence of the monarchy. Just as it was being finished, the old Houses of Parliament burned down in 1834. And some government leaders suggested using Buckingham Palace as the new seat of Parliament. One argument in favour of the idea was that the River Thames stank so badly from all the sewage and pollution it carried, and was so feared as the source of the recent cholera epidemic, that a site away from the river seemed like a much healthier alternative. In the end, however, tradition prevailed, and the new Parliament was built on the same site as the old. A competition for the best design was won by Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin, who had the idea of building it to echo the architecture of Westminster Abbey just across the street. By making it look medieval, they emphasised the long continuity and stability of the British Constitution. But they also took advantage of modern advances in structural iron and steam heating. The superb interior decoration of every part of the building makes it a continuing source of pride and pleasure. Likewise, the high quality of debate, especially the twice-weekly Prime Minister's Question Time, makes a visit to Parliament a priority. Just as the Houses of Parliament look older than they really are, so do many other parts of London and Britain's other cities. The bulk of the big public buildings are Victorian or Edwardian, constructed sometime between 1830 and the beginning of World War I. That was an age of immense national confidence, in which British supremacy was embodied in brick and stone. Even the railway stations, which had a highly pragmatic reason for existence, became opportunities for fantastic elaboration, culminating in St. Pancras Station, whose iron and glass arch was one of the wonders of the age, and whose adjoining hotel, in decorated polychrome brick, remains one of the two or three most striking landmarks in all of London. Equally engrossing are London's museums, many of which also date to the Victorian era, and which continue to show you something new even after dozens of visits. The grandest of them, all housed in palatial buildings, are the British Museum, whose entrance is reminiscent of the Parthenon in Athens. The Victoria and Albert Museum, named for the Queen and her husband Albert, whose premature death threw her into mourning for the rest of her long life. And the Museum of Natural History, a miraculously beautiful structure, crammed to the rafters with interesting exhibits. There are also dozens of specialised museums, also on the grand scale. Among my favourites is the Imperial War Museum. Filled with the weapons of the two world wars, uniforms, paintings, films and dioramas. Another is the Science Museum, which traces British achievements in science and technology and features the first steam locomotive ever to travel at 30 miles per hour. Side by side with the museums are the art galleries, so extensive that to attempt a visit to all their rooms is a recipe for exhaustion. The grandest are the National Gallery, which fronts onto Trafalgar Square, the National Portrait Gallery, right next door, and the Tate Gallery. In recent years, a converted power station on the south bank of the River Thames has gained an excellent reputation as the Tate Modern. Even if you're lacking in sympathy for avant-garde art, you should visit it to see the breathtaking Great Hall, which used to house a set of mighty turbines and now offers a vast space for monumental art installations. Getting to the Tate Modern will also give you the chance to cross the Millennium Bridge, which opened in 2000, but had to close almost at once because of its alarming wobble. It's safer and more stable today, showing you the Tate Modern as you stride one way across it, and St Paul's Cathedral as you saunter back towards the north bank of the Thames. Depending on who you are and what you like, you might want a tour of Britain linked to some special interest. In recent years, for example, some of the most picturesque castles and colleges have offered Harry Potter tours, showing the particular rooms and quadrangles where scenes from the Harry Potter movies were made. Of more durable interest, and already a centuries-old tradition, are literary tours. Certain authors are linked so strongly to particular landscapes that they've become inseparable. Thomas Hardy transfigured the counties of Dorset, Wiltshire and Somerset into Wessex. And it's possible now to tour the sites he used as the originals for The Mayor of Casterbridge, Far From the Madding Crowd and Tess of the D'Urbervilles, including the towns of Dorchester, Salisbury and even Stonehenge itself. Similarly, Wordsworth and Coleridge tours will take you to the areas of the Lake District that they love best, and where they lived for many years. College tours in the old university town of Oxford will show you where J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis lived and worked. The Lamb and Flag and the Eagle and Child, two pubs nearby, were the meeting places of their literary circle, the Inklings. You've heard the old saying that the pen is mightier than the sword. One of the places where you can believe it might be true is in the churchyard of Sutton Courtenay, a pretty village in Oxfordshire. Among the gravestones is that of Herbert Asquith, a powerful liberal politician of the early 20th century who was Prime Minister during the First World War. Last time I was there, it was untended, half overgrown with weeds. But nearby is the simple grave marker of George Orwell, the author of Animal Farm and 1984. It's become a shrine at which fresh flowers are placed regularly by literary pilgrims. And when I was there, it was surrounded by a small and appreciative crowd. It's all the more impressive in that the name Orwell, which was a pen name, is not even mentioned. The grave reads simply, "Here lies Eric Arthur Blair," and the dates of his birth and death. As you can see, there are many reasons for visiting Britain. Some places that nearly every visitor is likely to want to see, and others with more limited appeal. This series of lectures will approach the topic in three ways. First, I'll talk about the eras of British history and we'll visit many fascinating sites associated with each of those eras. Second, I'll divide the country up into areas and point to the most engaging places to visit in those areas. Some will be geographic regions like the Northeast. And in these, I'm going to enlist the help of Paul Meyer, who will give you an idea of what the local dialects sound like. Others will be more specific, such as the lecture devoted to the two ancient universities of Oxford and Cambridge, or the three lectures devoted entirely to London. And third, I'll present a set of thematic lectures, including four on literature, one on art and artists, one on sport, one on war memorials, and one on seafaring. There's a logic to this sequence, but you don't have to follow it. If one of the lectures strikes you as particularly appropriate to your interests, you'll find it can stand alone, self-explanatory. In addition to guiding you through these approaches to visiting Britain, I'll also offer some advice about how to plan a tour, when to visit, and how to choose among destinations when time is short. You should use this course in advance of travel as a means of deciding why you want to visit and what you want to see. It's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that you must check off a list of vital sites and events, which in England usually includes the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace, Stonehenge, Shakespeare's birthplace in Stratford-on-Avon. There's nothing wrong with any of these, I suppose, apart from the mob of others who've all got the same idea. But Britain is so rich and varied that you might ask yourself whether alternatives, especially lesser known but equally interesting alternatives, might not be rewarding. The stone circle at Avebury, for example, is easily the equal of Stonehenge, and you won't have to fight the crowd to approach it. As a college professor, I often enjoy visits in my office hours from groups of students who say, "Hi, Professor Allett, we're going to England this summer. What do you think we should see?" I answer, "That's wonderful news. I recommend you to avoid Stonehenge and Stratford and go to the places you haven't heard of to get a sense of everyday life in a foreign country. Remember, it's a real country full of real people, not a quaint theme park. But if there's one place you really must not miss, it's the National Railway Museum in York. Promise me that you'll go there." They leave grinning. When I see them at the end of the vacation, they tell me, "Hi, Professor Allett, we had a great time in Britain. We saw Stonehenge, Stratford, the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace, and the Cotswolds. It was fabulous." To which I answer, "I hope you didn't forget about the National Railway Museum." They giggle, "Didn't think you really meant that," and leave. I admit that I'm far from immune to the must-see impulse. On my first visit to Paris, I literally couldn't avoid going to the Eiffel Tower. A magnetic force seemed to draw me there. On my first visit to Copenhagen, I couldn't avoid going to see the Little Mermaid. Well, my verdict is yes to the Eiffel Tower, but an emphatic no to the Mermaid, which in my opinion is not worth a second glance. Have faith in your own convictions. Go to see what you most want to see, and learn enough about it beforehand to make the visit a logical end point of your reading. And be prepared to change your plans at short notice if you see that a particular concert, play or parade is taking place, even if it's outside your usual range of interests. Here are a few practical tips. First, Britain has a mild climate. Low winter temperatures rarely go below freezing, and high summer temperatures rarely go above 75 Fahrenheit or 24 Celsius. It rains a lot, so it's a good idea to take good waterproofs or to be ready to switch from planned outdoor to indoor activities. It's a long way north of the equator, which means that the days are long and the nights short in summer. One of the most exhilarating evenings I can remember was a late evening climb to Arthur's Seat, a beautiful hilltop overlooking Edinburgh, on Midsummer's Eve. 10 o'clock came and it was still not dark. 11 o'clock came and the sky just dimmed a little. Even descending at midnight, there was still light enough to see. Those huge days are invigorating. To go in winter, by contrast, is to face short days where it's hardly light before 9 o'clock in the morning and getting dark again by 4 in the afternoon, even in the south around London, with an even shorter day in Scotland. On the other hand, spring and autumn visits are less likely to be crowded midsummer tours when tens of thousands from all over the world are flocking in, augmented further by Britons themselves, whose school summer holidays are usually the second half of July and all of August. And remember, if you rent a car, think very, very carefully every time you get behind the wheel and have to drive on the left. The great paradox of tourism is that no tourist wants to be jostled by thousands of other tourists. it's simultaneously possible to be one and to think that all the others are horrible. The two best ways to deal with the paradox are to go at times less likely to be crowded and to go to the countless beautiful but hitherto neglected or undervisited places of Britain. I'm going to talk about some of the busiest and some of the most obscure sites in these lectures, but I promise you, the scope in Britain is inexhaustible.
Lecture 2. Prehistoric Britain.
The first time I saw Stonehenge, I was 7 years old. It was a windy summer day in 1962. In those far-off times, you could just stop your car by the side of the nearby road, walk over the fields, and wander among the great standing stones. That's what my family did. We were the only people there. And as my brother and I tried in vain to climb the vertical rock monoliths, my father explained that the Stonehenge had been there for thousands of years, but that no one was quite sure what it was or why it had been built. Those are the days. Located in Wiltshire in southwest England, Stonehenge is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, one of the most heavily visited places in the world. Thousands of people can be seen there every day, and it's extremely difficult to find it unattended by crowds. Quite apart from the literally millions of tourists from around the world, an annual convergence of New Age spiritualists surrounds it to pray and meditate during the summer solstice. In 1985, a group of them scuffled with police in an event remembered as the Battle of the Beanfield. No one now is allowed to walk among the stones. The collective impact of their trampling would quickly degrade the monument, so they're kept at a safe distance, except for a select few on special occasions. Traffic management in the area is a big headache. For a while, I used to encourage Americans heading to the southwest of England to visit the stone circle of Avebury instead, about 20 miles away, where it's still possible to walk among the stones themselves. At Avebury, they could avoid the mob and get a sense of the awe the great standing stones evoke. But I admit that Stonehenge is, despite everything, a compulsively fascinating place. Archaeologists using carbon dating now reckon that it's about 50 centuries old, begun around 3000 BCE, and expanded often over the following millennia. The great trilithons, which feature one great stone laid like a lintel over two vertical stones, were probably set up when Stonehenge was already 1,000 years old. Was it a temple, a burial ground, an astronomical observatory, a healing centre, or a royal dwelling place? Interested and ingenious people have been speculating for hundreds of years, and archaeological work in the Stonehenge area continues up to the present. What we lack, of course, are written records from the builders. Every theory is based on fragmentary discoveries and deductions from limited evidence. It's pretty clear, however, that tens of thousands of people were involved in its construction. The sheer size of the stones and the fact that many of them were quarried in Wales at a site more than 100 miles away bears witness to a phenomenal amount of hard work and a hierarchical social organization. Historical reenactors have tried dragging blocks of comparable weight on rollers or on greased tracks to see how long it would take and how many men it would involve. Moreover, what the casual visitor sees above ground is only the tip of the iceberg. For miles around in every direction are partially or wholly buried stones brought from elsewhere. Other circles of post holes, the remains of wooden hinges, and hundreds of burial chambers, which provide the evidence that this was a bustling, highly organized, densely populated area for many centuries. Modern techniques like LIDAR enable us to picture the landscape above and below ground level more clearly than ever before. The medieval chronicler Geoffrey of Monmouth, writing in the 12th century, suggested that Stonehenge was a site for healing. He believed that touching the stones had healing effects in his own time, and that it had been built by Merlin, King Arthur's magician. The first man to excavate at Stonehenge was the Duke of Buckingham, who dug a pit inside the central circle. John Aubrey, a 17th century polymath, did a little more excavation and noticed a set of indentations in the ground that are now referred to as Aubrey holes, possibly indicating additional structures beyond what is now visible above the ground. From 1720 to 1740, William Stukeley resumed the digging, and he was the first person to notice a great avenue leading east out of the Henge toward the nearby River Avon. Stukeley was a doctor, a Freemason, an Anglican clergyman, and a friend and biographer of Isaac Newton, the kind of enterprising, well-to-do gentleman of the Enlightenment, who was interested in everything. Eager to travel and see as much as he could for himself, he became familiar at first hand with many of the area's important sites. He was a founding member and first secretary of the Society of Antiquaries, which can be thought of as the first British group dedicated to archaeology. A fine draftsman, Stukeley made countless drawings of ancient sites that were later destroyed or damaged. Cooperating with the astronomer Edmund Halley, he theorized that Stonehenge had been built about 460 BCE and that it was aligned with the Earth's magnetic north pole. He also believed that it had been a worship site for druids, devotees of a patriarchal cult among the Celts, whom Julius Caesar encountered when the Romans first invaded Britain. Stukeley himself was nicknamed the Arch-Druid by friends who found his investigations amusing. The situation improved a little in the late 19th century. By then, archaeology was becoming more systematic. The best survey to date was done in 1872 by William Flinders Petrie, subsequently the leading British Egyptologist. He's credited with establishing the patient, systematic, and painstaking methods of 20th century archaeology. At about the same time, Charles Darwin visited with his family for a picnic, and later pointed out that the work of millions of earthworms over thousands of years would gradually shift everything at a site like this and cause the stones to sink into the ground and the embankment to diminish in size, an insight never subsequently forgotten by later excavators. In 1882, Parliament passed the legislation that recognised the need to protect Britain's ancient monuments. Stonehenge was put on the list right away, along with 67 other prehistoric sites. Government protection included the decision to return some fallen stones to the upright position. One of the great trilithons, which had fallen over in 1797, was restored in 1958. It can be agonizing for modern archaeologists to read about and see the evidence of their predecessors' work, because by current standards it was so primitive and destructive. Today's archaeologists dig carefully through every layer of ground with trowels, sift every ounce of soil, make meticulous drawings and photographic records of every stratum, and diagrams showing exactly where every find was made. Not so their predecessors, brawny workmen, who often just shoveled the earth aside in the hope of turning up heaps of treasure. Only since the 1950s have archaeologists had radiocarbon dating, a technology that enables them to date organic finds more accurately than ever before. They're also caught in the paradox of knowing that they too are going to seem crude in the eyes of their successors, whose methods presumably will be even more refined. That makes them hesitate, lest their work in turn destroys evidence of the very thing they're hoping to recover. Among the many theories about Stonehenge, one was advanced by the American astronomer Gerald Hawkins in his 1963 book, Stonehenge Decoded. In his view, Stonehenge was a kind of computer for predicting solar and lunar eclipses far into the future, a theory that other astronomers found convincing. It was already known that the henge was oriented to sunrise on Midsummer's Day and sunset on Midwinter's Day. Perhaps this was the key. Archaeologists, such as Richard Atkinson, who'd been excavating there for the previous 15 years, didn't like the idea that their painstaking work was largely beside the point, and subjected Hawkins to some strenuous refutation. By now, however, the two disciplines have been linked in an academic specialisation named archaeoastronomy. Peter Newham and Alexander Thom, following up on Hawkins' work, have demonstrated further ways in which the distribution of stones and local markers can be used to predict solar and lunar events. There's clearly some substance to these claims, even if Hawkins was wrong with some of the details. When DNA analysis was added to radiocarbon dating, our ability to understand the human dimensions of Stonehenge in its heyday increased. Among the burials are people who came from the Mediterranean and from present-day Scandinavia. It appears to have been a Europe-wide destination long before the rise of the Roman Empire. The work and the wondering continue. English Heritage, the agency that cares for Stonehenge, has to balance many interests and constituencies. The archaeologists want to excavate. The neo-druids want to worship. The tourists from around the world want to see the site as undisturbed as possible. Yet their own presence creates an immense and continuous disturbance. After protests against the poor quality of the visitor centre and the surroundings, a new centre opened in December 2013, which includes a fine museum exhibiting many of the best artefacts discovered at the site. From there, a bus takes you close to Stonehenge itself. No other traffic is allowed in the area, and the old road, on which I first visited, has now been closed. I've spent a fair amount of time talking about Stonehenge, but if you're interested in exploring prehistoric Britain, southwestern England has many other important sites. Avebury, which I mentioned earlier, is bigger than Stonehenge, but slightly less impressive because it lacks any structures. There are no trilithons, and the great standing stones are not dressed, that is, not cut into neat blocks, but are irregular in shape. On the other hand, the number of stones at Avebury and the height of the ditch and embankment surrounding them is more impressive. A medieval village was sited there, and roads and dwellings still cut through the circle itself. Sheep graze among the stones to keep the grass short. We know that in the Middle Ages, many of the stones were deliberately knocked over by people who thought the circle was a site for devil worship. In the 1930s, many of them were returned to their standing position by the archaeologist Alexander Keeler. Under one, he found the skeleton of a man whose pouch contained a pair of scissors, a probe, and a few coins that dated from the early 1300s. Keeler concluded from these tools that he might have been a barber, the man who in those days often doubled as the local surgeon. Had the unfortunate fellow been struck by the rock as it was knocked over and thus entombed there, or had he died earlier? In any event, this particular stone has been known as the Barber Stone ever since. Keeler was heir to a great Scottish marmalade fortune, and incidentally, the company is still going strong and the marmalade still tastes great. Keeler devoted his money to acquiring land in the Avebury area to prevent its development. Working in the interwar years, he was one in a generation of archaeologists to realise the value of aerial photography. From the air, shapes and patterns that are invisible at ground level suddenly emerged, disclosing the presence of abandoned villages, the lines of ancient walls, and dozens of other places where the ground had clearly been modified by human actions. His book, Wessex from the Air, published in 1928, was the first British book on aerial archaeology and helped set in motion a revolution in the understanding of ancient Britain. The whole of this area, Dorset, Wiltshire, Somerset, and part of Hampshire, The area that Thomas Hardy called Wessex is dotted with old hill forts, some of which date from the Neolithic era, when hunters and gatherers were settling down to become farmers instead. Natural hilltops were made more secure against attack by the building of ditches and embankments. Inside them, communities could build their villages, gather the farm animals when under threat, and keep watch on the surrounding country. The passage of time has gradually eroded many of these hill forts, but a few are still impressive, none more so than Maiden Castle, just south of Dorchester, the county town of Dorset. It's 430 feet high, part of a natural ridge, giving excellent views in every direction, and an ideal defensive site. Hardy himself described it as a heavy, high-shouldered presence, an enormous, many-limbed organism of antediluvian time, lying lifeless and covered with a thin green cloth which hides its substance. Archaeologists have shown that Maiden Castle was built over a long period of time. The cumulative effect is superb, a succession of great ditches and embankments, ramparts enclosing a massive oval interior, giving wonderful views over the surrounding lowlands. It was extended and occupied continuously between the Neolithic era, more than 4,000 years BCE, right through to the 6th century of the Common Era, or AD. The successive layers of ditches and banks are so elaborate that archaeologists speculate they might have been intended as decorative rather than strictly functional defences, a way of declaring the supremacy of their chieftain. Mortimer Wheeler, the archaeologist who excavated Maiden Castle, in the four summers between 1934 and 1937, and published a book about it in 1943, had a gift for publicity. He held regular press conferences, encouraged public visits to the site, and drew in more people to take an interest in this sometimes forbidding and recondite activity. His work helped establish the principle that Maiden and comparable hill forts were essential parts of the nation's heritage, as deserving of protection as castles, palaces, and cathedrals. Another impressive Iron Age hill fort is Cadbury Castle in Somerset, widely believed in former times to be the real site of King Arthur's Camelot. Excavations have shown evidence of a battle there at the time of the Roman invasion of Britain in about the year 43 of the Common Era. In addition to Maiden and Cadbury, the remains of other hill forts are scattered widely throughout the south of England. At Old Sarum, near Salisbury, a later cathedral and a Norman castle were built inside the great perimeter of the earthworks. Even more striking in its way is Silbury Hill, because in this instance the hill itself was actually built by human labour. It's conical, almost 100 feet high, standing on otherwise level ground, and has a flat top with a 100-foot diameter. Archaeologists believe it to have been started in about 2400 BCE, probably by slave labour, and continued over a long period of time. But excavations show it not to have been a burial site. Subsequent use by later populations has modified the site. A Roman road swerved around it, confirming the point that the hill was already there when the Romans arrived. Silbury Hill was a gathering place every Palm Sunday for people from the surrounding villages in the 17th and 18th centuries. As with Stonehenge and Avebury, however, its original purpose remains uncertain, despite plenty of plausible-sounding theories. Incidentally, this is another one I climbed in the days when it was still allowed. Now it's off limits, but still worth visiting, which is easy enough as it's only a few miles from Avebury and Stonehenge. Along with the earthworks and stone circles, the southwest contains some wonderful prehistoric objects, including the Uffington White Horse, on the border between Oxfordshire and Berkshire. The bedrock of the area is chalk, naturally white, and the horse was made by scraping out trenches, removing the grass and earth, and filling them with crushed white chalk. The work was probably done in the Bronze Age, around 1000 BC. It's a stylized rather than realistic horse, much longer and lower than an anatomically accurate horse drawing, and strangely modern in its appearance. Its similarity to some horses depicted in Celtic art also help place it in time and suggest the influences that contributed to its unusual appearance. Every 7 years, from the Middle Ages right into the late 19th century, a local fair was held beside the horse, during which local people cleared away the grass which would otherwise have overgrown it and obscured it. Among the many puzzling aspects of the white horse is that it's located in a place not easily viewed from any other place on the ground. All our best pictures of it come from the air. Surely such a spectacular design was meant to be seen by people as well as by the gods. Theories for this slightly inaccessible placement include the idea that the ground itself has slipped over the centuries, making its exact location different now than hitherto. Later generations carried on the tradition. Among the best of later chalk drawings on the monumental scale is the giant of Cerne Abbas, also in Dorset. Made essentially the same way as the white horse, it depicts a man, presumably a warrior, holding aloft a great war club, which is echoed by his great erect penis. Early antiquarians speculated that it too was prehistoric, or that it depicted the Roman god Hercules. Current theorizing, sadly, favors the idea that it was made only in the 1600s, because it's not mentioned in any older document. It might be a parody of Oliver Cromwell, the military dictator or Lord Protector of England in the 1650s. It too is difficult to photograph from ground level, and is best seen from the air. Like the older ones, however, its survival has also depended on generation after generation of local people keeping the outline distinct. Otherwise, the grass would quickly return to shroud it altogether. Across this district of great prehistoric riches lies the Ridgeway, an ancient route along the hilltops that since 1973 has been a recognised and government-protected national footpath. It goes from the southwest in Wiltshire, starting close to Stonehenge and Avebury, all the way to Buckinghamshire, on high ground nearly all the way. Historically, the advantage of a ridgeway was that the ground was unlikely to be swampy. On this high ground, travellers would be less vulnerable to ambush. To walk it from end to end, or just a few sections, is to enjoy superb views of this rich and still mostly rural part of England, and to encounter one after the next old burial mounds like Wayland's Smithy, hill forts and patterns in the ground whose presence bespeaks ancient habitation and ritual life. Radiocarbon dating has shown that the Ridgeway has been in use for at least 5,000 years. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that prehistoric sites in Britain are confined solely to Wessex, though if that's your principal interest and you have limited time, it's definitely the logical place to go. In the hill country of Devonshire, Derbyshire, Yorkshire and Cumbria, there are many more stone circles and remains of ancient earthworks. Among the best are Castlerigg in Cumbria, part of the Lake District, where a circle of 40 stones create a ring in one of the most scenically dramatic areas of the district. Last time I was there, rain pelted down and a ground mist rose around the ancient stones, giving a delicious sensation of being removed from everyday life. Also impressive is Brisworthy in Devonshire, an oval of 24 standing stones, most of which were set upright in 1909 by an enthusiastic local clergyman. There are hundreds of still visible stone circles, around 1,300 of them in all, and every traveller can single them out with the help of an OS map. OS stands for Ordnance Survey. Starting in the mid-1700s, the British government's military department recognised the need for high-quality maps. Beginning in Scotland, after Bonnie Prince Charlie's failed uprising was defeated at the Battle of Culloden Moor in 1746. The first map was made of the Scottish Highlands, but gradually the attempt to map the whole of Britain was extended, with the result that for more than two centuries now, we've enjoyed access to phenomenally detailed maps of every part of Britain. All over OS maps of rural districts, you'll find the word tumulus, meaning an ancient earthwork or burial mound. They are innumerable. Many are now nothing more than a cluster of rocks or a bulge in the landscape. But they remind passers-by that people have been living and farming these lands for thousands of years. The best prehistoric site in Wales is the Great Orme Copper Mine near Llandudno. One of the reasons Britain was in close contact with the rest of Europe, even in pre-Roman days, was the presence there of large copper deposits. The mine at Great Orme was dug out in the Bronze Age, probably beginning around 2000 BCE, and continued to be worked over the course of 1,000 years or more. The miners brought malachite to the surface, a greenish-blue copper ore from which the metal could be smelted. The miners must have used primitive candles or smoky lamps to light their way. By our standards, their tools were primitive, either stone axes or pieces of antler, hundreds of which have been found in the mine. One of the pleasures of Great Orme is knowing that it was completely forgotten for hundreds of years before being accidentally rediscovered in 1987. Continuing exploration since then has disclosed a labyrinth of passages, making it almost certainly the largest prehistoric mine in Europe. In Scotland, too, the remains of prehistoric cultures are widespread. Many are at or below ground level, where there isn't much to see. But more than 100 brochs still stand proud, albeit half-ruined. Brochs are mysterious circular buildings, double-walled and built using rocks without mortar, over which, as with everything I've mentioned today, archaeologists have speculated and debated. Some scholars believe the brochs to be old fortifications. Others say they were just strong farmhouses. And others again favour the idea that they were places of worship with ritual significance. They're mainly found in the extreme northeast of Scotland, one of the remotest parts of Britain, and in the even more inaccessible Shetland and Orkney Islands off the north coast. The best preserved of them all is at Mouser in Shetland, still about 40 feet high, with an internal spiral staircase between the walls. On the mainland, the two best, close to one another, are Duntelve and Duntrodden in Glen Elg, on the coasts of the Western Highlands. Scotland's best prehistoric site, however, Skara Brae, is on the Orkney Islands off the north coast. These windswept, treeless islands are among the most inaccessible places in Europe, but can be reached by plane or ferry boat by anyone with enough time, money and determination. Older than the pyramids of Egypt, older than Stonehenge, Skara Brae probably dates back 4,000 years, to a period when the climate was rather warmer than it is now. The site was unknown until the 1850s, when a windstorm, even more scouring than usual, laid bare the remains of old buildings, on what until then had seemed to be no more than an uneven earth mound. The local lord, or laird, excavated four houses. Edinburgh University took over more systematically in the 1920s, and by now, eight low houses have been fully dug out, along with the stone passages that linked them. The people who lived in them appear to have survived by a mixture of farming, herding and fishing, to judge from recovered fragments. Stone furniture survives in several of the houses, and countless everyday objects have been discovered. One contributor to the debate over Skara Brae, however, a museum curator from Glasgow named Julian Spaulding, argues that such well-built stone objects show the site to have had a ritual rather than domestic purpose. He claims it was something like a sauna heated by hot rocks immersed in water around which people would gather for worship and storytelling. As so often with prehistoric sites, it's impossible to be sure because the remains are so fragmentary. Archaeologists debate whether the settlement was abandoned in the face of a sudden catastrophe, one of the region's great storms perhaps, or whether gradual climatic cooling made it steadily less habitable. In any case, it seems to have been abandoned around 2500 BCE, after about 600 years of continuous occupation. Skara Brae's antiquity is a great point of emphasis among Scottish nationalists who've campaigned in recent years for full independence from England, and did so with renewed vigour after the Brexit election of 2016. Skara Brae enabled them to claim that civilization came to Britain not from the classical south of Europe, but from the north, making Scotland